First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report, the most expensive BS Report we've ever done. And frankly, I couldn't be more excited. Our old friend Chuck Klosterman is in Germany. We're going to get to the reason why, but let's get him on the line right now. Chuck, you there?
I am there. Or I'm here, I guess.
Explain to us why you're in Germany.
Well, that's kind of a good question. I'm still not totally sure myself. I got asked to come here and teach at a college in Leipzig, Germany. So I'm.
What's the college?
The University of Leipzig.
And what are the courses that you're teaching?
Teaching one class on it's sort of like an overview of 20th century American popular culture.
Hmm.
And I'm teaching one class, which is essentially a writing class.
Like fiction or nonfiction?
No, more like criticism and. You know, literary nonfiction, I guess they would call it. I don't know. It's very weird. I don't know how it happened. I just got emailed, and they emailed me a year ago and asked me to do it. They wanted me to come in, like, 3 weeks. So I said, there's no way I can just move to Germany for 3 months in 3 weeks from now. So they said, okay, well, we'll ask you next year. So then 6 months later, they asked me again, and I kind of arbitrarily said yes because it seemed so far off. And then eventually I had to be here. It's a weird situation. It's in East Germany, like the old kind of, you know.
Old school Germany?
Yeah. So, the students speak English, but most of the town does not. There's no English speaking television channels, just I get CNN International and the BBC. All the movies are dubbed. The grocery store is sort of unfathomable to me. It's weird.
What do you mean by unfathomable?
Well, I guess it was more confusing than I thought it would be. I mean, I guess I knew it would be strange not being able to read or speak the language of an area, but the food is different here. Most of the food, like except for basically cereal and booze, the food is all different here. So it's hard to, you know, like the microwave is absolutely incomprehensible. I've been here like 7 weeks now, and I still don't really understand how to use it because it's a microwave and an oven at the same time.
Oh,
and
man.
All the directions on it are kind of like they seem to be for a robot, like they're little robot schematics or something.
Right.
And it has like 11 different temperatures it can be. So that has been sort of a struggle.
Is the cuisine different? I mean, is it like a lot of like heavy food and dark beer, all that stuff?
Well, there's a lot of beer drinking. There's a lot of meat. You eat meat. I mean, it's good because I'm basically carnivorous. But
yeah.
this asparagus is a big deal here. I don't really get it. It has some sort of, I don't know, reflection on the day-to-day working class or something. Like there's a bar that's asparagus-themed.
What?
It's asparagus is in the name. Everything on like the bar menu, on the food menu, all involves asparagus. There's asparagus all over the place. I don't know. And
maybe
I guess
they
white
like to...
asparagus is sort of like the working man's asparagus, and green asparagus is sort of for the affluent upper class. I don't know.
Maybe the Germans like to smell their own pee.
Is that true? Have you done that? I'm not a big asparagus fan.
Well, no, asparagus makes your pee smell.
I thought it made it a different color.
Yeah, that too. It makes it very yellow.
It makes vitamin B. I don't know.
That vitamin B does it too. But yes, asparagus leads to smelly pee.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons my daughter loves it. But
oh, yeah, you have kids now. That's so
I do.
Weird.
I have kids. Yeah, and
two of them, right?
I have two, and you learn things like asparagus is actually a fun vegetable because it makes your pee smell. Things you would never normally think about.
Did you always want to have kids, or was this sort of your wife's idea? I was never explained to me why you did it. Did you write about this at some point? I just never saw it.
You make it sound like we had decided to get a dog. I basically wanted to have kids because I wanted to have at least one kid that would watch sports with me because my wife didn't really like sports. That was really my overriding reason other than to
See, no, that can't be true.
No,
I don't really believe yourself.
No,
that.
I know. You know what? I feel like the people I knew who had kids, they turned into Hare Krishnas about it, and I felt like as a writer, I would have to explore that territory. And you'll feel that way too. I just feel
You see, that makes me nervous because it makes me think that you're going to become one of these guys who writes about his kids all the time.
No, I haven't.
So
I
almost feel like you're consciously choosing this.
No, well, I've consciously chosen not to do that.
Well, you wrote one column about taking your daughter to a LeBron game, I remember.
Yeah, the Clippers game.
Yeah.
I've written two columns that featured my daughter, and that's it, because I'm very careful not to go down that road, because I have seen it happen. I've seen it happen with some of my friends. Like, they have a kid. And I guess the cool thing about having a kid is you're experiencing all these mundane things that happened in your life years ago over again with the kid through them. Like something like Halloween, which I could have given a crap about. And now Halloween is like one of the most exciting days of the year because she's so excited about it. So those are the benefits for having a kid. The downside is...
Rediscovery of Halloween.
Rediscovery of a lot of things. The downside is that, you know, your life is basically over. That's it. I could not go to Germany.
You implement your wife and now your kids in your writing. Do you ever feel nervous about that, of using sort of these extensions of you as, like, not as just a narrative device, but just a sort of like a I don't know.
The kids thing makes me nervous because a lot of people reading do not have kids and don't give a crap about kids, and I've been on the other side of that, and you don't want to be reading, you know, 1,000 words about Teletubbies, stuff like that, because they're just not going to get it. So I think it's like... Yeah, you want to sprinkle it in, but I don't think it's something you want to make a habit out of. It's not a good idea. And the bottom line is, kids, you know, until they turn about 3, they're really not that interesting anyway. I mean, they're interesting to the parents, but to an innocent bystander, not really.
Mm.
So that's the big issue.
Yeah,
but
I agree.
The one huge difference, though, is that I could never do something like, hey, I'm going to just go to Germany and teach a course. Like, you're kind of like trapped. It's like... Yeah, it's like getting a dog, but on a much larger level.
Yeah, well, I was a little cavalier about doing this, even without kids. It was more jarring than I thought it would be. I don't know what I seem like an idiot saying this, but somehow I kind of overlooked the complexity of moving to another country for 4 months. I don't know why I didn't think this was going to be a bigger problem, but it, you know.
Yeah. Well, what did you do with your apartment?
My girlfriend keeps track of my apartment.
Oh, so you left the girlfriend behind?
Yeah, well, that's
interesting.
Made things complicated as well.
I would assume.
Yeah.
And that means you can't like have a little dalliance with like a 19-year-old German college student who doesn't speak any English.
No, it's actually more like going to rehab, sort of, except for the drinking. Because I'm sort of in this very Spartan apartment. I'm like living in an apartment that... basically like I would have lived in college, except less interesting because there's nothing fun here. I don't have a car. I pretty much teach these classes during the week. During the rest of the other days, I just sort of kind of live this solitary life where it's very alienating because most people around, you know, I can't read the newspapers here. I can read the internet, I guess, but, you know.
But it's probably good from a writing standpoint because you have a lot of time to think and overthink and write some stuff down and do all that stuff.
I guess maybe it's kind of like going to a writer's colony, I suppose, except it's obviously an incredibly small colony. But it's odd because the place I'm living at, all it is like other professors and stuff from around the world. So like there's these physicists from Sweden living here. There's there's some Asian kids here. I don't know what they're studying or pursuing, but they're awesome ping pong players. There's some opera singer in this building, a visiting opera singer. So she's, I hear this operatic kind of caterwauling during the day. And then I just see a lot of guys who are just some kind, you know, just foreign academics who just seem very brusque. I mean, it's weird. It's one thing you realize when you go any place, I guess, in Europe that I wasn't as conscious of is America is a much more polite country than I realized.
Right.
I mean, especially compared to Germany. I mean, here it's sort of like they think it's really weird that, say, I would get off a bus and, like, thank the bus driver. They would never do that. Because they'd be sort of like, well, that's his job. Why would you thank a bus driver? That seems ridiculous. And they don't even look at that as sort of as a polite act. They sort of see that as sort of the superficiality of Americans.
Well, what's funny about that is that you live in the least polite city in the United States, in New York City. So
yeah, I don't know.
Going from there to Germany,
I don't think New York is an impolite place.
Oh, stop it!
No, I don't.
Come on.
I really don't. Because here's the deal. And I'm sure you must have noticed this when you visited. If you act like you don't know where you're going in New York, four people will come up and try to give you directions because they all remember coming to New York and being lost. People I find in New York love trying to help. Like the speed of life is really fast. So that might seem abrasive, but it doesn't seem rude to me.
Hmm. Well, I would maybe say more. You're right. The speed of life is different. I think it's more you're just surrounded by so many people at all times. Everybody kind of goes on autopilot to a degree. So, yeah, you're right. If maybe the instructions say that's not a good example of that. But on the other hand, like, I'd never interact with cab drivers in New York City. They don't seem interested in interacting with me. But if I'm in Boston, they'll talk to me.
Yeah,
it's little stuff like that.
That's probably true. I mean, that's just as you move west, that happens more. Like cab drivers in Austin are really talkative. Yeah.
Right. Well, here in L.A., it's different because people are surface polite. But, like, you'll be friends with your neighbor, and then all of a sudden you realize that they moved. And they didn't tell you they were leaving. It's stuff like that. Like, it's not, like, very genuine.
Where do you live?
I live in Los Angeles, a little bit near Hollywood. It's not as L.A. as you would think. Like, I remember growing up and thinking, well, there's a lot of misconceptions.
You live in Los Angeles near Hollywood, but it's not very L.A.?
No, but I mean, there are neighborhoods in L.A. that aren't what you think they would be, I guess is my point. Like, and I guess I had a lot of misconceptions when I moved here, mostly based on 90210 and the fact that, like, you could live on the beach, but also it would be a three-minute ride to Beverly Hills. And you just assume everything is near each other, but everything is like 25 minutes away from each other. So the
yeah, I know. I'm surprised you've even taken a cab in LA. You never see that.
No, only to the airport. Really, that's it. But it is interesting though that I don't know why Hollywood does it either. But I guess it's just out of simplicity. But the idea that everything is right near each other. You know, like in 24. Something happens and Jack like can go from the anti-terrorism headquarters and just immediately go to Burbank, and he's there in 3 minutes.
Well, it would be interesting though if these shows implemented 14 minutes of driving. I guess you really want stark realism. It's like, did you like the movie Brown Bunny? You must think that's awesome.
No, I hated Brown Bunny. Well,
I didn't think it was that bad. I thought it was underrated.
Really? It almost
yeah.
ended Chloe Sevigny's career.
Well, that was a curious decision but the thing is, it's like I saw that movie in the theater and Yeah, and it was interesting because the only people in the theater were sort of like kind of really bookish, kind of severe-looking girls and guys who looked just like Vincent Gallo.
Ah.
Like guys who look just like the director.
That's a weird phenomenon because the weirdest movie I've ever seen in the theater was Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, which I saw because I drove up from college and I had like 3 hours to kill before a Celtic game. And it was like me and 12 other people in the theater and they were all guys by themselves. And I thought all of them were serial killers or were thinking about becoming serial killers. And that's why they were there. So maybe that's like.
But that would be an interesting philosophy to use in all movies, to assume that the crowd is always going to replicate the story.
I think it would be for quirky movies. I think, you know what I mean? How's the University of Leipzig basketball team?
They don't have one.
Oh, no.
I don't believe they have one.
Do you play pickup hoops there?
There's a basketball court by my house, and I did buy a basketball, and I go down there and I shoot once in a while, but no one plays games in the court because the pavement is really uneven. This is not the world's most stimulating conversation, though. I gotta ask you, let's get something that might be a little more interesting.
I was stimulated. I wanted to find out about pickup hoops in Germany.
Because I was curious if, like, the players here would all be like, if they would have all the sort of stereotypes of European players.
That's what,
like, if the big guys would be like, you know, like kind of deft passers, but like, you know,
soft,
not but soft, and like all, you know, all the guards would be sort of like larger than average and really thick, and they would all sort of, you know, but I haven't been able to get a real good sense of that yet.
Well, that's what I wanted to see, if there's a lot of flopping, because what the Europeans, and wait, Argentina is not in Europe. The Europeans and the South Americans.
It's sort of like there's the U.S. style of play and the international style of play now. And it's really strange because I think over time, like, you know, there'll never be a day, even if it's 50 years, 200 years from now, there'll never be a day when America will play soccer as well as they do in Europe. And there'll never be a day sort of probably where, you know, we're like, if American football grows in popularity, that like the, you know, it's American football's big in Germany, but they'll never be as good as the U.S. However, basketball could actually completely swap over time, because they have such a different philosophy over here about coaching basketball.
Yes,
that just this idea that, like, they're just, every player is going to learn sort of every skill unilaterally. And it's never, you're not going to be specialized. And over time, it will be interesting to see if that sort of becomes the kind of the dominant way, the dominant philosophy. Because then, if America switches over to that, it may be too late. Then the whole world may be equal.
But then you got to also throw in the way that the American basketball system is structured now, where it's all AAU and these summer camps, and everybody's trying to get the attention for themselves. Nobody really plays team basketball as much as they did. So you got that going too. You got America going in one direction, and then Europe and South America doing the fundamentals thing.
Well,
could be interesting.
But it would be interesting, though. Let's say that it gets to a point where over half the players in the NBA are foreign. You know,
right.
That motive would start cropping up in Germany and Croatia and Argentina. There would be this idea that these kids would want to get noticed because of the huge financial windfall. But even that being the case, even if they had the exact same motive, if you're a kid in, like, Buenos Aires as a kid compared to a kid in Chicago, if you're just kind of ingrained with this idea that regardless of your size, you're supposed to possess all of the qualities of, like, kind of a straw man basketball player.
Right.
That, I think, might give you an advantage over time, you know?
Well, a lot of the big men who became good big men were people who had growth spurts later on. So they had developed some of the skills of the perimeter guys before they became the tall guys.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
or
well, that's
like
the kind of, having like Yannick Noah that happened to, but, you know, that's not really, you know, panning out. Yeah.
So you've basically missed the whole NBA playoffs.
I saw one game. I was able to really see the game 7 between the Celtics and the Cavs. I got it for whatever reason. I could find that on the internet with a really clear feed. Otherwise, I'll try to watch these games. You know, they start out here. I'm 6 hours ahead.
Right.
So the East Coast games start at like 2 in the morning, and the West Coast games start at 4:30. They're almost unwatchable. And I'm watching it, you know, it's just hard to really get a clear image. I was, for whatever reason, able to see that game 7. I wanted to bring up something, because I just, before you called me, I read your column about Garnett.
Right.
And I feel like that you sort of glossed over the real critical issue in sort of his performance in the postseason. There's only a couple lines. It seems really clear to me that the reason he seems to sort of be a less than spectacular playoff guy is because he plays hard during the entire regular season and is the only great player who does. That every other great player seems to play differently during the regular season compared to when, you know, in the playoffs, and he does not. He plays these, he's like a static thing. Like right now in this series against Detroit, under these circumstances, I would rather have Rasheed Wallace, because I feel like there's a strong possibility he could be a much better player in a given situation than Garnett, because we know what Garnett's going to be like.
Right. The reason I glossed over it was because I've written it before about Garnett doesn't have gears. Like, a lot of these guys have gears, but Garnett is just in fifth gear. So when it comes, when there comes a time in a game where, you know, you have to have that switch that says, all right, I got Josh Smith on me, I got to go down low and get us some points. He doesn't think that way because he has trained himself to play the exact same way at all times. But the interesting thing was last night, you didn't see it, game one, he was much more aggressive against the Pistons. It was almost like he knew Rasheed Wallace was going to be defending him, and they have a long history together. And it was like he realized he needed to come up with a couple extra wrinkles, and he was going down low, and he was banging bodies and kind of being the guy that we want him to be. Now,
the
Celtic fans, and I think NBA fans, too.
You shouldn't say we, Bill. That's
I can't help it.
Terrible to me.
I can't help it. I know, but you don't like teams, though.
Well,
you're the only sports fan I know who doesn't have teams.
First of all, it doesn't matter how much. I mean, I know you love the Celtics, but even if you weren't a journalist, you're just a guy, you're living in Boston, you're still not on the team.
But in that case,
you're not drawing a check. You're not, there's no we involved.
But hold on. In that case, I used we, meaning all the Boston fans. I didn't say we, me and the other guys on the team.
Oh, well, okay. I guess that's true.
But I am guilty of using we occasionally, as in we won tonight, things like that, which I agree with you. I'm not proud of it. But the weird thing about you is that you don't have any favorite teams. You're like a sports atheist.
I have, you know, I feel like that in any given game I'm watching, I have a rooting interest. But I mean, I think I'm not just going to root for a uniform over time.
A rooting interest, but in what way? Like, who would you root for in a Celtics-Detroit series? How would you come to a conclusion that would make you feel passionate about one of the two teams?
Well, were I watching the game, I guess is it going to be Friday night?
Yes.
Is it Thursday night?
Well, no, Thursday would be game two.
When I look at the guy, like, you know, I was obviously this fanatical Celtic fan during the 80s. I was a
because
kid,
you liked, you know, the guys on the team.
I liked the guys on the team. And I kind of liked the idea of the Celtics and what they seemed to represent to me. And as a little kid, you know, I read a lot, so the history of the team I thought was really interesting to me. Now, you know, when I look at that team now and I look, you know, look at guys, you know, looking for guys that I like, well, I like Garnett because I liked him when he was in Minnesota. I have mixed feelings about Pierce. Don't really like Ray Allen. The guys that I interviewed I did a story for the Times Magazine about the Celtics, and to them, some of them were interesting. Some of them I felt are kind of uncompelling characters. So they're playing Detroit. I guess I would almost be rooting for Detroit to win to even the series, so that I could potentially root for the Celtics in Game 3.
So you root for just seven-game series and dramatic endings.
Because I like sports. I don't like teams, you know.
Yeah. Now, is this like a fair commitment thing, you think? Or?
Well, but what are you committing to? Because you're not. Well, it's a one-way relationship. You're committed to the Celtics. They're in no way committed to you. They have no relationship with you. You have a relationship with them. So it's sort of like you're committing yourself almost to like a poster of Bo Derek or something.
But then you have other people who also like the team, and you have shared experiences you can discuss and argue about.
Yeah, but you're relating yourself with strangers then? I mean, what
about
unifying
friends?
Elements do you have? Well, you're friends, but what about, there's certainly people who love the Celtics who you probably despise. Do you like being allied with them?
I would argue that the only way you feel this way is because you grew up in a state that did not have professional teams.
See, that's not true, though, Bill. I mean, yeah, there was a team in Bob Simmons. Yeah, there wasn't a franchise in my hometown, but the relationship you have with the team that basically with the Vikings, the Twins, or whatever, you know, they were on television every week. They dominated the media. You could potentially go to those games whenever you wanted to. You know, every kid in my school was wearing a Viking sweatshirt, it seemed like. I mean, it didn't seem any different than if I'd lived in Shakopee or something, you know.
Right. So your sports atheism is not a result of where you grew up in North Dakota.
I don't think so. I mean, I guess if it's some sort of something that I can't, you know, maybe it's some subconscious thing that I don't even realize, but I don't think that's connected.
Have you
because
written
all about the
this?
Because a lot of the people I grew up with are like, you know, are fanatical about, you know, specific players or specific teams, or, you know.
Have you written about this?
Well, I don't know. To a degree, I suppose. I mean, it's something. You know, it's strange to write about. I mean, and this is, I think, one thing you're really good at is sort of writing about the experience of fandom, or, you know, and fanaticism, and just sort of the idea of trying to understand your life through something else.
Right.
It's really hard for me to give in to the emotional part of fanaticism.
Because you're afraid of getting hurt.
Well, you know, that wouldn't be a bad argument in a sense, because, yeah. I mean, certainly the disappointment I have felt from losses is much greater than the happiness I have felt from teams winning.
Is it possible that you were a huge Vikings fan and you were so traumatized by a Vikings loss that you've now repressed all the memories of being a Vikings fan?
Well, no, because I was a Packer fan growing up. I've always been the kind of guy who hated the home team. I think if there was any loss that would have that defined my view of the world is when the Niners beat the Cowboys in 1981.
Right.
Because I think I was at an age in my life where I loved the Cowboys so much, and I was so emotionally invested in that game, and ended, kind of so traumatically that maybe that was the point. I guess it was that I'd been 9.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, we either would have been really good friends in college or bitter enemies. I'm not sure what, because I have a feeling we'd have argued about this really for like an entire week freshman year, about
that's
the fact that you didn't have a team. And then
were you the exact same guy in college as you are now?
No.
How are you different?
It's a lot stupider.
Well,
really, like,
I mean,
dumber.
Besides obviously you're smarter, but like what personality wise?
I would say a lot stupider and very immature, because I was an only child. Are you an only child?
No, I'm the last of 7 kids.
Yeah, see, only children mature a lot later, I think, because they don't have older brothers and sisters, you know, telling them, why are you doing that? Don't do that. So you kind of have to learn it on your own. So I would say I was a late bloomer. You had 7, you have 6 brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I got 2 brothers and 4 sisters.
Yeah, see, I think brothers and sisters, it's a good thing in a lot
of
ways.
Are you Catholic?
Not really.
Well, you were. Your family was Catholic, though.
Yeah, I was baptized, but...
Yeah. It's really rare to see Catholic families with one kid, is all I'm saying. I'm not questioning
this is true.
I assumed a guy named Simmons from Boston would probably be Catholic. I
actually wish that I had at least one sibling now that I look back at it, because it would have been fun to have somebody to complain about my parents with. I think that's another underrated thing about brothers and sisters. You have these other people that you can discuss your parents with.
But now I wonder, are you only saying that because of like Kelly Taylor's relationship with David Silver? Because they really sort of bonded over that element, I think.
They did, and they weren't even really brothers and sisters.
Well, yeah, were they
brother and sister?
Yeah, I guess they were.
Funny you mention this, because it's on SoapNet right now. The junior years, right after all the horrible things happened to Kelly Taylor, and I was thinking how they missed the boat with sexual tension with her and David, kind of because they weren't related, so you could have gotten away with it.
Maybe
episodes, you know what I mean? Like, oh my God, we shouldn't do this, but then they do it. Big ramifications. You know what I'm saying?
It would have made sense, too, because it's like they kind of ran out of tragedies to happen to Kelly Taylor.
They did. Well, that was one of my questions.
Like, she was like raped like 7 times or something, and like she was burned alive, I think, and then she joined a lesbian cult, and then I think there was
there's a single white female plot.
There was a shark attack at one point.
Yeah. Well, that was going to be one of my questions for you. I don't know if you knew this, but One Tree Hill, in an ingenious way to keep the show going, they actually moved everybody forward 4 years.
Mm.
They just did a flash forward. It came back. It was 4 years later. I feel like if the 90210 people had thought about this in like 1996, that show's on for another 10 years.
Well, yeah, they did not like breaking the narrative though in that show.
No,
you know because the thing is they were so tied into they always were trying to tie themselves into popular culture,
right?
Like David will be working at the radio station in 1993 and you know, he'll be like, oh, I got to put this new Porno for Pyro song on or whatever, you know, like there,
yeah.
Or he quotes Wayne's World or something, you know.
They also used to do, they used to try to take real life plots and integrate them into the show. Like Brenda was competing against somebody for a play and the crazy, she's in love with Steve Sanders and she tries to get him to pull the Tonya Harding on Brenda. They would always try to weave that in.
Well, and you know who does that better than television? I like Rex Morgan, MD, you know, like the comic strip, and like Mary Worth. They always sort of liked it, you know. Like a lot of times you'll be reading like you know, Rex Morgan, and it'll be like it'll be in the 90s, and like suddenly somebody will have AIDS or something, you know.
Mm. Well, I don't know if you knew this. I don't know if no news has trickled to Germany, but they are redoing 90210.
Yeah, and like Kelly Taylor is going to be like the counselor or something.
Yeah, not only that, but that news broke on the same, basically the same month that the Raiders of the Lost Ark, the fourth movie, comes out. I felt very old this spring. It's been one of my older springs between those two things. Like the thought of like me and my friends taking our kids potentially to a Raiders of the Lost Ark movie is a little strange.
You know, I like being old. I'm glad I'm old now. People complain about getting old. I love it.
What do you like about it?
I think it's better. I think it's better being old. I like being able to, like, have conversations about things that are now history, but I actually was there for them. Like,
that's
if I'm talking about, like, you know, somebody about, like, the hostages in Iran or something. It's like I didn't actually only read it. I do remember this. I like being able to sort of complain about modernity. You know, I like being able to, I feel like I just, I'm more comfortable. I think I'm going to be, I can't wait until, like, I'm in a rest home. Because to me, that seems like it's going to be like college for old people. Because you're just sort of in, like, a little dorm room and there's people to play Risk with or whatever. And, like, I like the food at old folks' homes. Like, you know, I like soft food, like mashed potatoes and chicken strips and stuff. Although I have a fear that by the time we're old, they're going to all convert to, like, old people food in the future will be, like, young people's food now. So it'll be, like, burritos and pizza and stuff. I'm really hoping that the old folk home does not evolve. Because
my
I think it'll be...
Well, my fear is that... by the time we get to that age, they'll have so many scientific advances that they'll be keeping us alive like 40 years longer than we need to be alive.
That's already happening now.
We'll be like 125.
I think we live about 40 years longer than we need to.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, you know, I mid-50s, that's about perfect.
I see you finding a favorite sports team in your late years, finally grasping onto the concept.
Like some double-A baseball team or something?
Yeah, something that kind of innocent. Yeah, like a minor league hockey team or something. So when are you coming back?
I come back in August.
Oh, no. So you're missing the finals.
Totally. I'm missing it all.
Yeah. You're missing a potential Celtics-Lakers finals.
I know it's going to happen, too, because I'm here. Although, I'll say this. I know I sound like a jerk for saying this, but here's what I won't miss if that happens.
Yep.
There's too much media now. So there's going to be 1,000 columns about people remembering like the 84 finals and the 87 finals. And there's going to be all those idiotic response columns about how like actually the Lakers and Celtics weren't that great. You know, I'm sick of all these people who are stuck in like the 80s NBA.
The then backlash
somebody,
columns.
Then there'll be like there's be these stranger columns that will be like that people highlighting the fact that, well, they only played three times and people have exaggerated the reality of this rivalry or whatever. I don't think that's going to be interesting. I wouldn't be very excited to see the kind of the onslaught of clips that ABC would pour up on people when these games are on from the past.
I'm not excited for the comms about how the guys are much better now. The people who make that argument. Oh, much
yeah, that'll
now.
Be another one. Then there'll be somebody who'll be like, no, they'll say like, there'll be some kind of Freakonomics column that'll like break down the physicality and the shooting percentages and stuff of all the guys now compared to then. And they'll prove them to be, they'll be the same. That'll be somebody's conclusion. Actually, it's exactly the same. Well, so if the Lakers and the Celtics play, will you feel obligated then to write some kind of retrospective column about like the Bird Magic rivalry, because in a way that would almost be like a caricature now of what people would assume you would do.
I wouldn't, only because I've already written about the 84 finals. And in fact, I wrote a column like 4 years ago when the NBA was really in a bad place from just the standpoint of how the games were being played, like about how, you know, this is how it was in 84 and here are the reasons why it was better. And it actually, in my opinion, had a lot more to do with just the fact that the league was smaller. So you had so many good guys on each team. Like you know, nowadays the Lakers would never have Michael Thompson coming off their bench. Like it just wouldn't happen. The Celtics wouldn't have Kevin McHale as their sixth man in the 1984 finals because, you know, he'd be on Chicago or Memphis or Minnesota because there's 30 teams in the league. So I think that's the big fundamental difference. And I think you even see that now with the Lakers and the Celtics. Like the Lakers' eighth man is Jordan Farmar, who's been terrified in the playoffs. And the Celtics, you know, had to drag out Sam Cassell and P.J. Brown. And so I just don't think the league's as deep. So I'm not buying that argument. I also think the NBA became what it is now right around like 1981, 82. I really don't think there's much difference in how the game is played from then to now. Like I think they try a little harder defensively now, but offensively the guys were just as gifted back then.
It is, you know, there are people, I guess, at times overstate the impact from, you know, of the middle 80s on, you know, maybe on basketball, you know, Bird Magic saved the sport. I think maybe that gets said a little too much. Although I will say this, one thing that they really did instill, which you don't see in the other sports, is that they really did change the perception that your career could not be a success unless you won a championship.
True.
You don't see that. You only see that with NFL quarterbacks. Every other position in football, it's not an issue. Baseball is kind of brought up, but not really, because you really can't see a guy changing the game that much because it's always like one against nine or whatever. But they really did sort of make this, like, you know, when I always notice this, like when I watch the TNT show, you can tell in a sense that Kenny Smith has something over Barkley, which is crazy, but you can even tell it in the way Barkley behaves.
Yeah, it always comes up.
It doesn't matter how much those guys say, like, oh, my career was still a success, it doesn't bother me. It absolutely does, because the biggest thing that, like, Bird Magic and then to a degree Isaiah Thomas Jordan did is they made that an absolute prerequisite to being viewed as a great player.
What I never understood is why, if you didn't win it when you're one of the best guys on your team, how you could then still have the satisfaction when you do win it when you're not one of the best guys on the team. Like how that's the same experience for you. Like Karl Malone in 2004, supporting player on that team.
Yeah.
I never understood, like, so he wins with the Lakers and they pour champagne on each other and all that stuff.
Well, because what it would indicate is that he cares about it. That it's something that is central to his identity. That even if he's just a role player, you know.
But it doesn't change the fact that when he was one of the best guys on the team, they never won the title.
So yeah, but what it changes, though, is the idea that sort of he would prefer to be like a secondary player on a championship team than be the main player on a team or be remembered basically for his, you know, if he would have just retired before going to the Lakers, the memory of him as a player would be slightly greater because people wouldn't really have the image of him, as sort of a less physically gifted guy.
I think the John Elway is the most interesting case study for this one because that's somebody whose career was completely altered in the way we remember it by what happened.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he won the two Super Bowls, because he would be the go-to guy every time this discussion comes up of, well, he never won the big one. Well, and now he's just John Elway. Nobody even thinks of him, whereas Dan Marino, you see him and you think, he never won.
Well, I mean, Elway, I think now, it was so weird I felt with Tom Brady, sort of, how going into the Super Bowl this year, like, all the conversation was, Brady's probably the best ever. He's going to be the best ever. Like, you know, and now that they lost this one game, he immediately is off that argument. Now Montana's better.
Right.
Like, and there's nothing he can do about it unless he wins like 8 Super Bowls or something. He'll never be seen as, because he's perceived as not being this invincible force in championship games. It is a weird kind of way to examine someone's career. If you only look at their performance in the most critical times.
Well, his last 3 playoff losses came to Jake Plummer, Eli Manning, Peyton Manning. Kind of interesting for somebody who was being compared to Bill Russell 3 years ago. But you're right. It's especially that Giants Super Bowl, because, you know, I mean, I'm still getting over it. It'll probably take me a couple more years to grapple with what happened. See, you don't understand. You're a sports atheist.
I understand how it hurts to lose things. I mean, you know, everybody loses things. I guess I just, that was a situation where I went into the game rooting for the Patriots. By the end of the game, I was interested in seeing the Giants win. It just, you know, because here's another situation where it's like I did feel like Eli Manning now is suddenly freed from a ball and chain that seemed absolutely unremovable from his legacy, from his career. Now it's just over. It's just done.
Right.
Now he's just sort of like a mid-level quarterback who isn't a failure.
It's true. All right. Well, we got to go soon, but I have one last question for you because I really feel like everybody has to have an opinion on this. Kobe.
Well, as a player, as a guy.
Just Kobe.
Well.
For or against?
You know, I guess I would have to say for.
Interesting. Give me a reason why.
Well, he's obviously a problematic figure. I mean, the thing is, when I like watching Kobe Bryant play more than the degree of discomfort I feel from sort of thinking about what he means as a person.
Right.
It's kind of paradoxical, but he's like the most successful tragic figure I can think of. He's won all these championships. He's won the MVP. He's really been the best player in the league over the last 5 years. I mean, on balance, he seems like a kind of a confused person who sort of struggles with his own identity, and I don't think he gets any satisfaction from even the success he has. And there's something about somebody who's so good at something, not just among the best, but the best at something. He's right now on the face of the planet. He's probably the best basketball player there is. And he's not any more satisfied with his life than not just an average player, but a guy who installs air conditioners. Or a guy, you know, who sells Fords, or a woman who works as a receptionist at a law office in Omaha. Like, you know, he just sort of epitomizes how happiness has nothing to do with the context of your life.
See, I knew you'd come up with an interesting take. My theory on Kobe is, you know, I just think he's had a weird life. Like, you know, he lived in Italy with his dad as a professional basketball star there. And then he comes back. He's in a Philadelphia high school. And then he's in the NBA. That's who he became, is this guy who really had no foundation for anything. So, like you said, I feel like a lot of the times he's playing the part with stuff. You know, like he does that Aston Martin commercial, not because it was his idea, but because it sounded like something a cool person would do.
To be Gilbert Arenas in a way.
Right.
You would so love the idea that he could do something that people would perceive as likable. Or I think he just can't understand why. I think that, you know, even when he looks back, like, at his legal problems, or he looks back at the way people perceive Shaq compared to him, I think that it's just confounding to him because his perspective is so skewed. And before we get going, there's something I want to ask you quick.
Yes.
Because I know the people who listen to these podcasts, they're ultimately fans of you, and you bring a lot of people on, and you ask them questions. But there's always something I wanted to ask you, and I think a lot of people who have read your column over a long period of time would be interested in this. And we're talking about Kobe, sort of how he's kind of had this weird life. Well, your trajectory as a writer has been very weird, that basically you started somebody, you know, as this guy who was kind of, you know, one of these, I guess, a blogging pioneer or whatever, kind of writing for his friends. Now you have this massive audience, and it happened pretty quickly, to be honest. I don't know how big your reading audience is, but it's clearly in the millions, and this has happened over the span of a decade. How much has that changed the way you perceive yourself, and how much does that affect how you write?
See, even this conversation makes me uncomfortable because I just feel like we're writers and we write about stuff that happens to other people. So that
yeah, but we don't
we
live in vacuums.
No,
so
it's true.
It's impossible for you, sort of, not to realize, sort of, the degree that you're read, the influence you have, the influence, it could be arguable, but certainly your influence on how people think about sports, certainly on how young writers now write about sports. You're very aware of this. It's impossible not to. The amount of money you get paid makes you think, well, obviously I'm successful. So how does that impact the writing? Because it changes you as a person and the writer is the person. So how is your writing different now than it was 8 years ago or 6 years ago?
I would make two counter arguments. I really don't think I have changed as a person. I think people would back that up that know me. I think it can change people, but I think the only difference is that back when I had my old site and I was writing for, 2,000 people or whatever, you could take more chances. Mm-hmm. And the difference now is that if you write something about somebody, I might get an email about it or I might get a phone call about it from the person who's upset that I thought this or that I wrote this about one of their players. Like, it just seems like the bigger the audience for the column is, the more people that can read it, which is a weird thing to think of. But, when I was in New Orleans for the first Patriots Super Bowl and I wrote this column, I was making fun of New Orleans a little bit, having a good time. Oh my God, it's so dirty. And then it became like this local news story, like leading the news. And that's when it kind of dawned on me, like, oh my God, like people actually are reading. Cause you just assume, like, when you write stuff that only a few people are going to read it.
Well, have your motives for writing changed? Like, is the reason you would write about Kevin Garnett now different than the reason you would have written about, Paul Pierce, in 2003?
I would say not even one iota. Like, I
really,
you
talk about how you've changed since college, and that was just the process of normal adult maturation. How can the process of becoming, certainly within media, very famous, being very wealthy, you live in a different city.
Keep talking about very wealthy.
Well, you're very wealthy compared to
where I was 10 years ago,
a bartender who you were when you started.
Well, here's the thing. I think.
And you wouldn't deny that you're wealthy. I mean, that would be false humility, I would think.
But the thing is, I still feel like I'm writing about the same stuff I would have written about 10 years ago. Like,
but
if I'm talking
motive, is your motive different though?
No, I just think I'm just trying to write about sports and coming up with ideas and arguments and stuff that I haven't read other people write. I think that's always been the same goal.
Really?
Does that make sense?
Oh, I don't disagree. That's a good reason. But
I just think as long as I'm continuing to try to come up with topics that I haven't read other people talk about or explore fully and angles and takes on things, then I still feel like I'm doing a good job.
Innovation is a big part of it.
Yeah, I would say originality. And also, I think you can back this up. I think somebody gets better as a writer, not worse. I don't feel like it's not like sports where you peak when you're 30 or 29 or something. I feel like you get better each year. It's like anything else. The more you do something, you feel like you're getting better at it.
But now, would you feel that way if I brought up other writers? Would you feel that is the case? I mean, that's because it's with athletics, it's very clear. There's a point. An NBA guy is basically at his peak at 28, 27.
Right.
You know, an NFL running back is at his peak at 26 or 27. What age is a musician peak at? You certainly wouldn't say musicians continue to improve as they grow older.
No,
although
in fact,
certainly
you could...
only in rock music. They do in blues, they do in jazz, but in rock music it seems like that most great work is done by people under the age of 30. Now, why is that?
With musicians, you could actually make the argument that somebody's first album is probably going to be their best album.
Now, why wouldn't that be the case with writers, though? Why is it not possible that the best writing I've ever done is already done? It's very possible. I don't know.
Let me ask you this. If you go back, let's say you read your first book again, are there like 300 things you would change about how you wrote it, or are you totally happy with how it was?
Well, I would probably change 300 or more things, but that's possible that would be a mistake. It's possible.
No, but I'm saying
maybe the reason that it worked was because I didn't. I mean, it would be sort of like, did George Lucas improve Star Wars by recasting it? I would say he made it worse.
I'm not saying you would change the ideas and the thought. I would say changing technically – mm-hmm. and structurally how you wrote stuff and saying like, wow, instead of 50 words to make that point, I could have done that in 27.
But I mean, do you
stuff
think
like
so?
That.
I mean, if you asked Julian Casablancas, he could go back and reproduce and rewrite and re-record the first Strokes record, I bet he would say yes. I mean, in an interview, he would say absolutely not. But in life, I bet he would love to be able to do that again. And if that were the case, if the record was more polished or if the vocals sounded were higher in the mix or whatever, would it be as good? Maybe it'd be worse.
I think music is different because, first of all, you can't discount the whole drugs thing with music. And then second of all, people can just make mistakes with how they, you know, the songs they choose for an album, the order they choose. Like, it's much easier to make a mistake that would have probably improved the record if you had to make it. Like, with Rumors with Fleetwood Mac, like, they left off Silver Spring, which should have been on the album. Like, that's something, like, that's very, like, wow, we should have put that on the album. That was stupid.
So
whereas with writing,
it's
a lot more subtle, I think.
So you suspect that you will be a better writer at 50 than you are now?
I don't know about 50 because I think...
Well, but now wouldn't that contradict what you just said earlier, that the writer keeps getting better?
No, I just think a writer's prime would be from 35 to 45, would be my guess.
Well, it's interesting that you're, what, 37, right?
Yeah, I feel like I should continue to get better. What?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to challenge you on this or disagree with you. I just think it's a really interesting question.
How old are you?
35. I'm going to be 36.
Do you feel like you're getting better or worse as a writer?
I certainly feel like I'm getting technically better. I kind of look at it both ways because I think that the things that a writer likes about writing are very different than the things a consumer likes about reading.
Yeah.
At times I feel like as a person understands themselves better, understands any kind of craft better, they start sort of becoming paralyzed by the realization of the potential of what writing can be or whatever. It's certainly harder to write now than it used to be when I was younger. There's no question about that.
Because you take more chances.
Fast,
well, I think you take more chances when you're younger too.
Well, yeah, and part of it, and that's also somewhat related to the audience. I mean, it would be, I think there was one of my books that if I had known it would have, it was going to be sell as much as it did. I don't think I could have, I think I would have freaked out. I don't know if I could have even wrote it. But that's the other thing I wanted to ask you about. What is going on with this NBA book you've been working on? What is the subject? No one seems to know. There's always these kind of these vague rumors that you're working on this NBA book, but nobody knows what it's about.
It's not necessarily an NBA book. I don't know what it's going to be. That's why I don't want to say anything.
Is it a nonfiction book?
It's nonfiction, yes.
It's nonfiction, yeah. And it's not necessarily about the NBA.
Not necessarily.
I don't know what it's totally going to look like yet.
So I don't want to say it's going to be this when it's not going to be this.
I'm not trying to trap you. I was just curious because
I feel trapped.
Yeah.
I'll know by the end of the summer exactly what it's going to be. I think. In a lot of ways.
No, come on now. So you're saying you don't know what the idea is going to be, but 2 months from now you will. You must have something of an understanding.
I'll have a better idea in 2 months.
Will it be a personal story?
I don't think so.
Okay. It's definitely about sports, though.
Yes.
Okay. And is it about an abstract idea, or is it going to be about something kind of specific and tangible?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. I'll know more in 2 months. I'll be happy to continue this discussion with you in 2 months if you get home from Germany alive, or 3 months. When you get home.
I mean, I would, you know.
When you're home in August, I'll have answers for all of these questions.
Okay, well, have me on in August. We'll be like one of those, you know, like, you ever listen to like the Jim Rome show? I used to listen to that in Ohio when I lived there. Like,
yeah.
And the best shows were always like where he would take no callers. I'll do one of these, and
yeah.
I will ask all the questions. And it will sort of be a chance for you sort of to kind of some, you know, publicly examine some of these things that, you know, your readership is completely unaware of.
Publicly examine things.
Well, but you're a public figure now, you know, you have a podcast.
So are you.
You're on television.
You're a public figure.
I was also really interested that you chose to go on television now. I think that's fascinating.
I think chose is a strong word and maybe not the right word.
Did you felt pressured into it?
I never want to do TV. I would be totally happy if I was never on TV, but
well, because I gotta say, I was
stuff
I was,
happens.
The way that they do those bits with you, it is a surprisingly good reflection of what your column is like.
Well, that's nice. Like I appreciate that.
I feel like it's because I was I did at first I was like, oh, why is he doing this? But then when I saw him,
evolved,
you went to Bismarck. I like that, but
I had to ask you about that.
Okay.
Is it true that North Dakota is literally the only state, I said literally again, I'm sorry, is the only state out of the 50 states that does not have a tourist attraction?
Well, I mean, it depends how you look at it. I mean, like, what's the cutoff for a tourist attraction? I mean, the Badlands are there, Medora is there, the Peace Garden State is there. I don't know if those are,
Here's the cutoff. Let's say you just graduated from college, and you're driving somewhere with your old roommate, and you're going cross country, and you're trying to go to every state. What would be the reason you went to North Dakota?
What would be the reason you?
What would be the reason? Because you go to South Dakota, you'd be like, oh, let's go see Mount Rushmore.
Well, I guess if you need a specific reason, you're right. There probably isn't one. I mean. In southwest North Dakota, there is this area called the Badlands that sort of look like almost like a lunar landscape. They're really interesting to drive through, but that's
right.
That's a geographic area. I don't know if there's a real
you go to Kansas City, and you think, let's go see a Royals game, or while we're there, the Chiefs are there. But North Dakota doesn't have.
You're really saying is they don't have a pro franchise there.
I'm saying they don't have. Not only do they not have professional sports, but they don't have like the go-to Mount Rushmore, Grand Canyon type thing either.
Oh well, you know what? That's not true. There is one.
What is it?
The geographic center of North America is in Rugby, North Dakota. It is the geographic center of the continent.
So now that's the answer I was looking for. That's interesting to me.
Yeah.
If you went there, you'd be exactly in the middle of the United States.
Well, although it's always kind of confusing because North America is not like a square or a circle. So I'm always sort of skeptical over how one figures out what is the exact geographic center of a landmass that sort of has kind of an abstraction for the coast and whatnot. But yes, that is the geographic center of North America.
Oh wait,
Rugby, North Dakota.
We literally have 2 minutes left. I said literally again. We have 2 minutes left because tape's going to run out. So
okay. Tell
us about your novel that you're trying to finish.
Oh, the novel's done. It comes out in September.
It's done?
Yeah.
What's the name?
The name of the book is Downtown Owl.
And it's your first novel?
Yes.
Killing Yourself to Live was a nonfiction novel, but it was nonfiction.
Yeah, in the U.S. I really only seem to say novel for fiction, but I mean... This is the first entirely fictional work that I've done.
And how are you feeling about it?
Mixed, I guess. I don't know. It was really hard to do. It was a hard thing to write. You know, it's of course you when you. I mean, I feel like my relation to it is really skewed because I was sort of engulfed with it, that's all I did for a year or whatever, pretty much. But I mean, I don't know if it's good or not. We'll see. I hope it is.
Wow, you just sounded like Ed Norton trying to sell the Incredible Hulk movie.
What?
You're missing this in Germany. Ed Norton is like refusing to sell the Incredible Hulk movie and promote it because it's 10 minutes shorter than they promised him.
I feel really weird about promoting anything like that because it just like you know. If you do a good job of promoting something, all it really means is you can convince people who really aren't your audience anyways to buy something that they're almost certainly not going to like, you know?
Right.
I know it's like my publisher's going to hate this if this is, like, you should probably almost leave this part out entirely, but it's really hard for me to tell someone that they should buy something I wrote. It seems like a weird thing to say.
I'm with you. You almost feel guilty that they spend money.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, and you just feel like a whore, kind of, you know?
All right, we got to go. You're coming back in August when you come back.
Yeah, I'll be end of July. I think I'm back. So why don't, if you want to do this again, I would
absolutely
have fun talking to you.
Yeah, good luck trying to get the Celtics-Lakers final in Germany.
Yeah, well, we'll see if I can break into a sports bar and confuse some soccer fans.
All right, take care. Good luck.
Target's a set off. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.